the way I describe it is I can play there. I can be me. I can be my joyful self and normalize it in a way that it's okay. You know, if I say something wrong, or, you know, maybe I make a squeak or I flap my arms or something like that, it's okay. It's perfectly fine, you know. And I think when you see someone for who they are, so accepting them, I don't need anybody to change for me. I don't need them to justify themselves like I had to all those years ago.
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you to get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. In today's episode, I'm talking to someone whose story will resonate with so many therapists who wonder if they're too quiet, too different, or too unsure to succeed in private practice. Croy Ryder is an openly gay AUDHD and dyslexic counsellor whose journey of self-discovery has taken him from working as a cleaner to building a thriving private practice. Through embracing his identity, and he describes this as being like his own version of a Kent Clark transformation, Croy found the confidence to step out of the sidelines and trust that his voice mattered. Just love the name of his counselling service. He now runs Louder Than Words Counselling, where he uses his lived experience to support clients, particularly those from neurodivergent and LGBTQIA plus communities. Croy believes the strength in shyness and is passionate about encouraging other neurodivergent therapists to believe they can build a successful practice just as they are. Croy, welcome to the studio. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's get started straight away, because you describe your journey as going from a cleaner to a counsellor. So quite a transformation there in itself. Could you tell us a bit about your path, your journey to becoming a counsellor, and what made you decide to train in the first place?
Yeah. As I say, I did start as a hotel room cleaner, which I guess, looking back, people watching, so kind of set me up for lots of things going on in hotels, lots of different people coming and going. So that looking back, I can see that. It wasn't actually until I lost my mum in 2013 that I kind of realized that I wanted to do something with this and to stop other people feeling the way that I felt, you know. Yeah. I am very open and honest. That event nearly took me with it. It was quite an eye-opening kind of event for me. Mm-hmm. The only way I survived it was, I know it sounds really cheesy, but I had a tattoo done and it allowed me to feel the pain that I needed to feel.
So it sort of opened up the pain for you. Yeah. Go on.
And then it was kind of something that, so obviously figuring out that I was autistic, which came a little bit later, but I was very shy. Yeah. I was always shy, very quiet. I describe myself as a country lad. I come from the country, you know, where if you have a haircut, the net curtains twitch and it's big news, you know. Yeah. So that's kind of where I grew up. But yeah, me and my partner decided that we would do a level two together. Yeah. So it is something that he did the journey with me. Level two was really interesting. There was a standout moment on level two where we were all asked to write down five things that we held dear to us, you know, and we had to give each one of those up to the tutor to basically give it away. And the last thing I had written was my mum, basically, and I was the only one brave enough to give that up, to give that over. That was hard, but I realized that if I wanted to help people, then I need to give up quite a lot of things and I need to be able to get to where they are and meet them in kind of their space.
Yeah. So it's sort of a way of almost like bracketing off your mum and the pain and, and that sort of stuff. So giving it away was sort of representative of, I'm not going to let this get in the way of my interaction with other people.
I did it. Mm-hmm. Level two was really, like I say, an eye opener. Mm-hmm. Then I guess you can say we kind of got the bug. So we thought, okay, let's do level three. That's obviously another step up.
Yeah.
Level three was great. It was in the evening. So the college was kind of empty. So again, it was quite good for me. Then we kind of went to the next stage, which was level four and a level five together. Obviously, this is the part where you get qualified.
Yeah.
I was really nervous about that because it meant mainstream college for me. It meant going during the day.
Yeah.
So that was really difficult because I was used to know people. You know, most things had happened in the evening where there was maybe an evening class going on, so there was no one around. So I had never been to college before any of this.
I was going to say, lots of stimulation if you're going into college during the day, a lot of noise, a lot of people. Yeah, really sensory overload, I should think.
Yeah. I mean, the closest I'd got to college is seeing it on TV. So it was like, okay, what are all these people doing here? Where are they going? And how do they know where they're going? Yeah. You know, this is the part where me and my partner got split up. We were not allowed to be in the same class. It was, so we'd gone to visit the college during the summer. A support woman who actually was ADHD herself. That's when I was questioning autism. So I kind of said, look, I think I'm autistic. And her words have stayed with me ever since, where you definitely are. It shines out of you.
Oh, and it's an interesting turn of phrase. It shines out of you. Go carry on.
I felt so vulnerable and seen for the first time, but also a little bit offended, I must say, that almost like, how dare somebody penetrate my armor and see through that? You know, I'd done such a good job of being me up to that point. So that was a little bit difficult. Yeah. The course leader questioned my ability to counsel, questioned my empathy. In fact, this stays with me for the wrong reasons, was, how are you going to counsel because you're autistic?
And so had that course leader already worked with you, or was this just sort of like
based on assumption? That was, you know, I wasn't even diagnosed at that point. It was just, I'm thinking this way. You know, needless to say, I proved her wrong, you know, which is a good thing for me. I didn't stop. Yeah. I've always had that determination of, maybe I am good at this. You know, I tried countless things before, worked in different department stores, things like that, done paper rounds when we were younger. This was it was different. It was definitely using all my skills that I know that I had, you know, people watching, listening, things like that. But again, it wasn't without its challenges, this level. Okay. I asked the question to the tutor as to, how do I bring in autism? You know, so during level four and the level five, I had gone through the diagnostic process. It's something that I felt I needed. I needed the answer. So growing up, I knew I was different. I thought, hey, presto, it's sexuality. That didn't fill the void. So it was, what else is there? You know, why am I so different than other people? You know, so when I got diagnosed, I always say, when I talk to people now, that there was no welcome manual. There was no confetti cannons going off. I would have liked that, but there wasn't. There was nothing. It was just kind of, here's the diagnosis, there's the door, you know. And so I'm in my 40s, so it was kind of early in the 40s when I got diagnosed.
Now there's so much, I mean, there's so much weight around the diagnosis as well, isn't there? Because there's a lot of sort of like, well, what if I'd known earlier, how might things have worked out? Plus maybe you begin to meet more discrimination almost, like you did with the tutor saying, well, you won't have any empathy if you're autistic. It's a big thing to be dealing with, isn't it? Tell us a bit more about that.
That kind of shocked me, because I thought, something inside me kind of said, you can do this. This is where you're supposed to be. So there was another bit where I was asking about, how do I bring autism into the contract bit, because I didn't want to lie to my clients. I thought, that's what congruence is. I need to be honest with them. This is me. I'm going to do things differently. Mm-hmm. And the tutor kind of said to me, his answer was, figure it out yourself, which was really no use to me. You know, I didn't know what autism meant. I hadn't heard it kind of growing up. It wasn't a word in our household. So it was, how do I do this? And what does this mean for me going forward? Mm. Needless to say, I did figure it out. And yeah, I am very honest with my clients now.
Yeah. Just as an aside, what do you do then? Because that was the question to the tutor that you wanted to figure out, you know, what do you put it in your contract? How do you handle it with your clients?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very honest. I tell them, you know, because obviously that is now my niche. So mm-hmm. I've learned to be really honest and open about it. I will say kind of, you know, when you're writing your profiles, it's taken a good couple of years to get used to actually not kind of taking other people's bits of profiles and putting all the safe space and confidentiality. And it's actually only recently that I've gone, do you know what? I'm going to write it from me. Yeah. This is going to be my story, you know, because that's who these people are coming to see. So I am very open and honest. You know, we have a little bit of a joke about it. I always tell them, if that's not okay, then I'm not the counselor for you. You know, there's somebody else out there. So that's kind of how I deal with it.
And what sort of response do you find that people have? I mean, you know, have people rejected you on the basis that you're autistic? And I say rejected, that, you know, decided to work with someone else, puts it more softly.
Not at the moment. No, I've never come across it. In fact, I would say I've had to kind of reject people on the fact that they don't sometimes understand confidentiality. Mm-hmm. So I've had to kind of say, actually, no, this isn't a right fit. But no, I always give them the option. You know, this, I think for me, autism, ADHD, dyslexia, it's the same as if you want a male or female, you know, counsellor. Mm-hmm. I will always say to them, you know, if you want a female counsellor, let me know. Yeah. You know, we can do something with that. Yeah. You know, we can find you a fit. You know, I always kind of call, when you're looking for a counsellor, I don't know why, but I always use Cinderella's slipper. Mm-hmm. It's got to be the right fit. Otherwise, you're not going to open up. You're not going to talk to me, and it's not going to go anywhere. Yeah. So it's nice to bring it to a human level, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and with that side of things, there's always that thing of, yes, I'm not great with small talk, but I will make it human. Mm-hmm. I will kind of ask the client how they are, how they're doing. I will let them know if I'm late, because my clients know I'm always going to be 2 minutes late. I don't know why 2 minutes, but I put it down to an ADHD thing. I'm always 2 minutes late. You know, so I let them know I humanize it, you know.
Yeah. So they you know, they've got their expectation then, haven't they? So sort of managing their expectations. So going back to, you know, this experience in college, so I was just thinking it must have been quite difficult because you were handling the sort of diagnosis and the fallout from being diagnosed, maybe, and thinking how is this working out in my life, and, you know, working on your own personal stuff at the same time as you were actually doing what can be quite a difficult sort of work anyway, which is learning to be a counsellor. You know, level 4 and level 5 are challenging enough without, you know, working through a diagnosis. So how did you find those years that you were doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just found my own way forward, mm-hmm. you know, figured it out, did a lot of research, tried to figure out why I was like this, and kind of looked back over certain things, certain events in my life. So it was difficult. But when you figure out, actually, there's a reason why you do something, you know, and a lot of it, some of it is quite funny. You know, I laugh often and go, oh, God, here we go again. It's a hyper obsession, you know, and yes, I might have 40 packs of noodles in the cupboard, but that's just how I am. I know that will pass, you know. So talking, figuring it out, doing a lot of research, you know, and again, it wasn't easy because a difficult part that kind of overshadowed that, which I'm fine about talking about now, was actually in college. I was actually sexually assaulted. So that was during level four and level five that I just had that determination. Something in me made me feel like that's where I was supposed to be. It's a very odd feeling, but I feel like all my life I'd been searching for something, like, I don't know, maybe a place to fit, you know, somewhere where people saw me, you know, but really saw me. So,
And you feel that being a therapist has given you that fit of this is where you fit in. Is that right?
Yeah. I think obviously we all remember our first client. You know, I was really nervous on placement. The doorbell went and my kind of placement person was, okay, it's over to you now. And I was like, don't think I can do this. I don't know how. You know, it's just going to be me and this person in the room, and this person is going to be listening to me and maybe holding on to what I say. So that was quite scary. I will say the first one was not perfect, but I can look back on that now and go, do you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It was just your first one.
You know, it took a while, but then I think the stabilizers kind of eventually come off and you find your own rhythm. You know, when you first start, you've got all this theory in your head. You've got your, because you're still kind of at college, you've got your tutor in your head saying, do this. Have you done the contracting? Have you mentioned this? So there's lots of kind of tick boxes to tick, you know. But when you kind of settle into it and you find your way of doing it, then I think that's where I became more comfortable. Like actually, people were listening, you know, and they weren't leaving, you know, they were actually taking notice of what I had said. So it was a new experience for me.
Interesting. So do you think sort of like in a sense that you feel almost more valued in this role than you do in previous roles?
I would definitely say yes. And I think I would say it's because of who I am, you know, because of the autism, because of the ADHD and the dyslexia. You know, because I see things differently. I'm not worried about what's inside the box. I'm more looking at the bigger picture, looking at what's on the outside. And I'm not afraid to challenge people. If I, you know, I've had it where if I don't believe someone, you know, with autism, my mouth just runs away with me. And before you know it, I'm sitting there and I've said to the client, I don't believe what you're telling me. So, but then you have that kind of feeling of, oh gosh, have I said too much? But somehow it keeps landing. I don't know how it's working. I wish I could almost train people like this, but I think it's the self-belief. I think it's knowing that actually I will make mistakes. I have, and this is a kind of exclusive, I guess. I have forgotten clients before. I'm human, you know, and it's that thing of, how do you deal with it? You know, because I feel bad, but then I just explain, actually, I'm really sorry, but, you know, this is the way I am. And people will slip through the nets, you know. And I think, like I said before, just humanizing it, telling people that I'm not perfect, you know.
It sounds to me as though, sort of in a sense, you've come to this place where you're able to accept yourself, you know, but perhaps the diagnosis has helped you in this, in that, you know, in a way, you know, we talk about accommodating people, and it's almost like you accommodate yourself, don't you? You're able to say, yeah, this is the way I am. You know, I will be 2 minutes late. That's just who I am. And you're able to think that that's part of me. It's part of my humanity. And there feels to me, what I'm hearing is this deep sense of, this is who I am, and it's okay to be me. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's taken a while, you know, because I come from a big family. So trying to find your place was really difficult. So I went very quiet. I flew under the radar. You know, I think it was a big thing when actually, you know, I came out as gay. That was kind of a big deal. You know, again, words that we hadn't heard before. So I was figuring it all out. But now I think I accept myself more now.
I know I'm
kind of, maybe there's one or two more diagnoses to go, but I'm still figuring out me. And actually, I think I quite like me.
Yeah.
I think I like myself a lot more now.
Yeah.
So it's that thing of when I am working with a client, sometimes they help me, but they don't know. I can't turn around to them and say mid-session, actually, you've really just helped me there. You've opened something up, you know. But often that's how it works. And clients never get to know that.
Yeah. It's relational, isn't it? That's the thing. Mm. You have an impact. It's not one way. You have an impact on each other, don't you? Because you're working together and you're building a relationship. So, yeah, I think it's really nice to acknowledge that, actually, that clients have an impact on you as well. And I think sort of something else I just want to say before I lose it, you know, you sort of talked about sort of perhaps growing up, you'd watch people. And I wonder if there's a lot of your neurodivergence that actually has helped you to understand people because you've had to work quite hard, in a sense, because it hasn't just come naturally. Because of the autism, you've sort of, like, in a sense, had to learn and had to people watch. And I wonder if that's what helps a lot with when you challenge people, because you've had a lot of practice at it, maybe. I don't know. That's just a thought.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we understand what masking is, when I was younger, I say dragged to weddings and kind of christenings, you know, we had to go. We were young. I was one of six. So we had to go. You know, and it was actually just watching how people act and how they do things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still people watch today when I'm in a cafe. I will watch the little old couple in the corner having a coffee together, or the couple that might be having a disagreement. You know, I do it in the supermarkets. Mm-hmm. I just watch all the time. And I think that helps, because then I've got something to draw on, you know, from relationships to cars. And I don't know anything about cars, but I have sat there and spoke about cars for like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I have literally, you know, kind of said back to them, am I doing okay? How am I doing? Because actually, I don't know anything about cars. So it's bringing it down to that human level, which then makes the client kind of react and laugh and go, actually, you're doing really well. So it's that I keep going back to that human level of actually, I'm enough.
Yeah, it sounds like that also introduces an element of comfort. Not comfort as in they're comforting you, but just more, you can be comfortable when you're in the room with me admitting that you don't know something. Because you're sort of modeling that, aren't you? When you say, am I doing okay? It helps them to know maybe that it's okay, like you say, to be imperfect, to be human.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point, is we all have this thing of, you know, we all know Freud and we all know that he didn't look at the clients. And, you know, we have that idea of you're supposed to be in a suit and a tie if you're a guy. And actually, I don't. I wear shorts. I don't wear shoes because, you know, we have carpets. So I'm in my socks. And clients will often say, you know, oh, am I okay? I've been at work all day. You know, I'm going to take my shoes off. I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I want the clients to get on the sofa, you know, to feel comfortable, you know, have a drink. If you want a snack, that's okay. As long as you're focusing on what we're talking about, I will kind of, as I've worked out recently, I go that extra mile. You know, if you want something, you know, obviously we all know we're not crisis services. We know that. But actually just going that little bit human extra, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want me to make a call or you want me to write a letter or you want to maybe message me in between sessions, that's fine. Yeah. You know, I think going back to what you said about the room, for me, my room doesn't look like other counselling rooms. You know, it's my brain kind of exploded everywhere. There's fidget toys everywhere. I don't have flowers in the room, but I have Lego flowers and people comment on them, you know. Yeah. It's just, I will also introduce the room to the clients for the first 10, 15 minutes. We talk about the room. Mm-hmm. You know, I ask them, is there anything here that actually is going to put you off?
Yeah.
You know, is it, even if there's something I'm wearing, like if I'm wearing a certain color, is it going to put you off? Because actually I can go and change.
Yeah.
I can take a picture out of the room. We can do that, because I think people forget the room is so important, because you're going to spend some time in there and you need to feel comfortable, because I've had it before where I've had counselling and actually I spent all the 50 minutes looking at this picture of the ocean going, I really don't like that.
Yeah.
And actually that was my focus for the time. But it is important, the room.
Yeah. And especially because you are seeing your divergent clients, that must be a real consideration as well, that there might be something there that could be really like sensory overload in some sort of way.
Yeah. I think it's, like I say, it's important to kind of ask your client, you know, be human, ask them, is there something in the room that's going to put them off?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they need a drink? Because actually, if they're thinking about the drink for the whole 50 minutes, they're not focusing on what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, so it's okay. You know, I think what I've come to realize is I'm offering a new form of counseling. I'm still sticking to the ethical side. And yes, I've got the core conditions as the basics, but actually we can do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, if the client wants to go outside and walk, we'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
If they want me to sit on the floor, I'll do that. My only limitations with sitting on the floor is I won't sit on a beanbag because I can't get out of the thing. Yeah. So that's not great.
Yeah. So it's very sort of client-centered in a sense from what you're saying. You know, really try and work with what the client actually needs. Did you have any sort of fears and doubts about starting private practice, especially as someone who was neurodivergent? Did it seem like it would be too difficult, for example? Did you worry about getting things done? Or tell us about your experience of thinking about doing private practice and how it was starting up.
It's always a tricky one because I don't remember really having any fears about it. I knew it was something that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that I was going to niche. I didn't know that. That was more of a fear. Like, if I niche down, am I going to lose all these other hundreds of clients? What about them? That's taken a while to kind of go, actually, there's thousands of neurotypical counselors out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's not as many neurodivergent ones. So actually, it's okay, you know. But I think it takes time to build. I'd say it's taken me a good 2 years, you know, to be okay with it. Yes, when you get qualified and you're kind of waiting for that first initial client to come through, there's always doubts. There's always those fears of, have I written the profile right? What if no one comes? And then you get the first one and you just do what you can. And reputation builds. I've learned kind of through each client and adapted, you know, and gone, actually, that worked really well, but that didn't work so well. So let's change it. Just as much as autism and that is fluid, I think we've got to be fluid as well and move with what the client wants, because they're paying to come and see us. But I think now, like I said, I've reached that point where actually I'm more comfortable. And I think that kind of, just like how the lady said at the start about it shines out of me, I think that kind of energy, when you feel a certain way, it can kind of empower other people and it kind of rubs off on them as well.
So tell us about sort of moving into your niche of working with neurodivergent people. Did you find, because they often say you don't find your niche finds you. Is that what happened, that you found that you drew neurodivergent people to you? Or just tell us how you arrived at the idea of working with neurodivergent people as a niche.
Yeah, so it was never something that I realized I was going to do. I did not know, like, age limits. Was I going to work with youngsters? What was I going to do? I was kind of like, okay, I don't really know, apart from I'm going to do this somehow. I think it found me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more and more, so I was very lucky. I work for an EAP service. For some reason, every person that came through, sort of every other person, ended up, we would talk about neurodivergence.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, you know that thing where people discuss about, listen to the universe.
Yeah.
It's trying to tell you something.
Yeah.
I think the universe got a little bit angry with me and was like, come on, you know, start listening. You know, I'm showing you this way forward. So it took a while. You know, like I say, I was worried about alienating other clients, you know, the neurotypicals, and being like, okay, that's quite a large percentage of people. So, yeah, I think it found me.
Yeah,
I'm definitely niched down now. I'm more comfortable there. I kind of, the way I describe it is I can play there. I can be me.
Yeah.
I can be my joyful self and normalize it in a way that it's okay. You know, if I say something wrong or, you know, maybe I make a squeak or I flap my arms or something like that, it's okay. It's perfectly fine, you know. Yeah. And I think when you see someone for who they are, so accepting them, I don't need anybody to change for me. I don't need them to justify themselves like I had to all those years ago, you know, justifying how am I going to do this, you know. And actually, I find that I have so much empathy that it just kind of helps me, you know, it helps me to connect with the client. So, my niche found me.
This really resonated with me because in Therapy Growth Group, I've found that I naturally attract neurodivergent therapists. And many of them say the same thing to me. They don't know where to start. They feel overwhelmed and confused. And they doubt themselves, often before they've even got started. And that can be a terrible feeling because it can just feel so much to do and you don't know how to do it or what to do first. So because I have a lot of neurodivergent therapists in my group, I really have worked quite hard to make it easier for people to be able to access what I've got in there for you. For example, with my 12 steps program, all you need to do is just do the one step a week. It only need to take 15 minutes. You don't have to think, what do I need to do next? You can just come in and follow the program. I also hold calls every week because one of the things that I find personally is if you ask me to do something in my own time, I find it really difficult to dedicate that time. Whereas if you say to me, this meeting will happen at this time and on this day, then I actually make sure that I'm there and that's how I can learn. And there's other people there as well, which tends to look after that part of me that likes to be alongside other people. Part of what those calls are about are body doubling. So you can turn up and you can work on your own stuff, but also get accountability. And I've introduced an accountability each week into the group so that at the end of the week, you can get a little dopamine hit when you tell me that you've actually completed something. So if that sounds like it might be helpful to you, please do take a look at my website, josephinehughes.com. You'll find the navigation to Therapy Growth Group on the front page. And remember, most importantly, that you don't have to do this on your own. There's support from me and there's support from other therapists in Therapy Growth Group. And now back to Croy. So where do you find your neurodivergent clients? How do you advertise?
So, like I say, I work for the EAP service, so some of them come through. It is kind of a whether or not I respond to an email of that particular client. And like I say, you know, it's a choice. And when I do reply, usually it ends up being a neurodivergent client. So yeah. I'm not sure how that happens, but that works. The other place is obviously the counselling directory. Like I said before, that's taken a while to get the profile just right and the picture. I'm not great with having my picture taken. Obviously, smiling, sitting still is not a great thing for an autistic person. So I kind of had that done professionally. Got some good reviews on that, actually. So it was like, actually, I can just be me. Because sometimes you feel a bit judged the way you look, the way you dress. Yeah. Are we going to take a picture outside?
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of them kind of that come through counselling directory. Website is also important. So. Yeah. They can kind of get a little piece of you on the directory.
Yeah.
But I think then they go to the website to see a bit more, you know. And I think it is the language that I've used. Lots of people will say, oh, you mentioned RSD. I've never heard that before. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but that's me. So I'm going to mention it because that was something new to me. And I think it's wording is really important, like accepting, like just recently we've updated the profile, obviously. I've now put that I'm out, I'm proud. So I've put that I'm gay on there, you know. I've put that I think it's important that we accept that there's more than two genders, you know, just so that clients feel welcome. Anybody is welcome, whoever they are. We will get to the bottom of what's going on. If you trust me, then I'm the counselor for you and I can be good at what I do. But, you know, there are times where people just don't fit. So. Yeah.
I think what's quite interesting, actually, Corey, as I'm listening to you, is it sounds like you feel quite comfortable with turning people away who aren't the right fit, or letting go of people who aren't right fit clients. So there's something around that I find quite trusting of the process, shall we say. Because I know that it can be very difficult when you're making your living from being a therapist. If you get someone who crosses your path and you're not quite sure of them, it's very tempting just to say yes and see how it goes. She says, having had this experience myself. But it sounds like you feel quite comfortable, if people don't feel right fit, to really direct them elsewhere.
I think, again, that's taken time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's that kind of being scared in the first part of, oh gosh, this is a client and this could do this. But actually, I think there are times when maybe somebody's kind of too close to your own situation, you know, what's going on, that sometimes you have to say, actually, I'm not going to be able to do this. And it reminds that, you know, sometimes clients remind us of people in our own lives that have hurt us or kind of given us trauma. And it's okay to say, I'm not the person for you, you know. And I think that is something that I've got more comfortable with, you know, knowing that actually, as long as I do it safely and I can kind of give them some names, or like I usually say, if you want somebody else, you know, that's where we're looking, then I'll help you find someone. I don't think I ever sit there and kind of say, actually, I'm not for you, there's the door. You know, it's always, I let them know what's going on. Because it could be me, it could be that the energy is off. And actually, I think it's okay to say, I know some other people that would be a better fit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And look after that. You're looking after the client then, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think your neurodivergence helps you with working with people in your practice?
Gosh. I think it just, because I accept them, you know, it's that acceptance. I don't need them to validate or justify who they are, because a lot of, well, speaking personally, a lot of my life has been justifying who I am. You know, hey, I'm autistic and this is why I do this, or I'm ADHD and that's why I'm a little bit late. But actually, it's okay. You know, I like I said before, I accept them. So it's that acceptance, going back to people watching, you know, drawing on those skills. Actually, neurodivergent people have great skills.
Yeah.
You know, we, like I say, we think very differently. So patterns, when a client first starts, I'm immediately looking for that pattern. I mean, the way I work with any client sort of the first time round is I always talk about a chessboard. So I have a blank chessboard in front of me and I need to know their support network. Who are the key players? Who moves where? Who's on the board? Who can we move off the board? And the clients like that because they then have a visual that they know why. I'm not just going, tell me about your childhood. They know why we're doing it. And like I say, talking about introducing the room, introducing me, you know, sometimes I have been known to color my hair. So sometimes I have to let the clients know, actually, I'm going to have different hair color this week. Is that okay? Are you okay with that? Because I know I've had a client that had a drastic haircut and I sat there for a good 10 minutes thinking, I don't know this person.
Wow.
I didn't recognize the person in front of me. So I brought it to the session and said, have you had a haircut? Have we met before? Have we had this session before?
Yeah.
And actually, it kind of breaks the ice to be human again. Yeah. So, you know, if there is a change going on, it's best just to let us know what's happening. So I will let the client know that actually, you know, like we've just recently had different carpets put down. So it's letting them know, actually, the room has changed.
Yeah.
And let's sit with that for 5 minutes. Are you okay with it? Does it does it feel okay? Yeah, it gives me, I think it gives me a little bit of an advantage.
I was going to say, for someone who's neurodivergent as a client, that must be such a relief that if they walk into the room and the carpet's changed and they're feeling that discomfort with it, that, you know, you bring that into the room so that they don't, that's something that perhaps a neurotypical therapist wouldn't necessarily think about. But because you've got that neurodivergence yourself, you understand how it might be impacting your clients as well.
Yeah, I think it's important because, like I say, most times a client's going to sit in the room for 50 minutes, and actually what I was just talking with my partner about this the other day, and I'm reminded of, so all the years ago when I worked in a hotel, obviously when you're cleaning, you don't always see things at normal level. And my boss actually said to me, "Get in the bath." And I kind of looked at her and was like, "Huh?
Really?
What do you want me, what's going on here?" But actually, when I laid in the bath, I could see the dirt in between the taps. I could see the ceiling. So what I tend to do now, and I would advise any kind of counselor to do it, is sit where your client sits. Sit where they sit, see what they see and where their eyes are drawn to, because it's a very different feeling when you're sitting in their space to when you're sitting in your comfortable chair. We all have that thing where we laugh and we joke about the chairs that we have. Is it a throne? Is it a cozy chair? What color is it? And it's got to be comfortable for us, but actually the client is equally important. So if you sit in their space, you will see what they see. Like the books on the bookshelf are really important, what titles you have out, because like for me, I have some queer books out and things like that, and trans affirming ones, so that when people are sitting there, they can see actually it is an accepting space. So I think, yeah, that's important to do.
Really useful. So one of the things that you said that I picked up on is that you describe yourself as being a cheerleader for your clients. How does that look like? What does it look like in your work?
I think it's going that extra mile, like I said before. If somebody needs something, I always let all my clients know that they can contact me in between sessions, that I'm open to that. I don't have my personal number out there, but I have a work phone, so I know that if there's a message there, I know what it's about, because it can be really damaging if someone is going through trauma and maybe they don't have anyone else. Like I said before, I will always tell them I'm not a crisis service, but actually, if they've maybe had a difficult doctor's appointment or they've had maybe a council meeting or something, and they just want 5 minutes just to let you know how it's gone, I think there's a difference between being there and then kind of shutting the door after 50 minutes and kind of going, actually, I'm not really bothered anymore. I think for me, like I said before, kind of creating that new version of a counselor, because we are in a different century right now, and we are doing things differently, so I think it's okay if someone wants me to call their GP for them, I'll do that. That doesn't need to be during the session time. I'm okay with that, because I think that's what keeps the clients coming back, because they trust you. The relationship is there.
It's that relationship, isn't it? And what have you found the most challenging about running your private practice? Perhaps, the business side, or is it self-promotion? What do you think is the most challenging aspect of running a private practice?
Gosh, I think this is quite an easy one for me, being an ADHDer as well. Note taking is really difficult. So I do take notes during the session because my brain works very differently. I introduce that. Clients are fine with that. That's all I do to organize a session, is grab my pen and my pad, and that's how we go. But it's after the session has finished, writing up the notes or saying that I'm going to do something for a client, maybe send them like an autism quiz or something like that, and I'll put a post-it note on it, but somehow my brain still doesn't see that bright yellow post-it note. So yeah, note taking is quite difficult for an ADHDer.
So how do you work with that? How do you help yourself to remember things like sending that autism questionnaire through? What do you do? How sort of do you support yourself?
So I guess I'm still learning. I'm very honest with the client, so I will always put a caveat in of, if you don't hear from me in a couple of days, please do reach out and give me a little nudge, and I explain why. So again, they know I'm human. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to forget things. I'm now going through coaching to try and figure out, is there a better way of doing this? Reminders are great, but I then need a reminder to remind me of the reminder. So it doesn't always work. So I think for me, just being honest with the client, you know, and saying, actually, I might forget this. I've just done that this week and just said, just remind me in a couple of days, you know, and I think they understand rather than me just forgetting.
Yeah, they know
it's much simpler.
Yeah. So if there are neurodivergent therapists who are out there, I mean, what you said already is really helpful. But if there's neurodivergent therapists out there who are thinking about private practice, what advice would you have for them?
I guess just kind of go for it. As I say, feel the fear and do it anyway. I think if you can remember that the theory is just a part of it, and the rest of it is actually just yourself. Bring yourself to every session. You know, be honest. Like I say, if you're going to be late, let them know it. But just accept that you're human, you know, and that you can do it. But, you know, because sometimes we always go on about the safe and confidential space, and some clients don't really understand what that means. They, they don't really know what that jargon speech is. So I always just say, be yourself and don't be afraid to be yourself. That's the best way.
Because I was sort of thinking, because you mentioned RSD earlier, and I was wondering, you know, as a therapist who's ADHD, whether rejection sensitivity dysphoria has an impact on you? Because it doesn't, the way you've been talking, you know, we talked about you not having right fit clients, for example, perhaps being late for sessions. Do you find that you're more sensitive to rejection, and how would you handle that in the, you know, in terms of running a business, in terms of running a practice?
I think it definitely was a bigger issue when I first started. It is something now that I've got, now I know there's a name for it.
Yeah.
I've got more used to when it's happening. So when it does happen, I can kind of almost talk to myself and go, okay, this is not about me.
Yeah.
This is not a personal attack. If they want a female therapist, I can't change that. I can't suddenly do that. So I think it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it is about talking to yourself and saying, it's their choice. They're paying for a service, and that's okay. It's like I said, it's not a personal attack. I've never had anyone say, you know, oh, it's your hair color or you're wearing glasses. It's, you know, it's never personal, you know, and actually I think I kind of almost kind of expect it sometimes. So like if I have people over to the house, like friends or that, I will, even though I've spent all day cleaning, you know, being autistic, that's what I would do. The first thing I will say to them at the door is, please excuse the mess.
Yeah.
So I'm almost expecting it. So, you know, I will talk to the client about it at the start. If I'm not the right fit for you, let me know, you know, and if you can't let me know verbally, then just stop the session. That's absolutely fine. And we'll talk about it. I think it's expecting it. I've learned to kind of put in that caveat so I know that it might happen.
Yeah. So do you find that RSD affects you in any other circumstances, you know, like with cancellations or, you know, people coming to their ending perhaps earlier than you'd expected? Is there anything like that going on for you?
I think it's mainly kind of shows up when, you know, sometimes we have clients that don't give you an ending and kind of move on. That's when I kind of sit there and go, okay, I need a little bit of time to process that, kind of, again, recognize that it's not me, but I've not had that ending, or just even to say goodbye, and to whether or not it's helping them. I think sometimes clients forget that we are invested. There's a bit of energy that we give to them, and actually having an ending is really important, just like I say, even just to say goodbye. So that's where it sometimes gets me, and I have to kind of sit with that and kind of just process it, and again recognize that it's not a personal thing, and hopefully that the client goes off and is okay.
And again, so that's just this sort of real theme of you, of self-compassion, really, that having your diagnosis has given you that understanding of yourself and understanding of perhaps how you react to situations, and being able to say, it's okay, that's just sort of part of the way I tend to feel, but it isn't actually personal to me. It's something more than this. Yeah, it's really helpful. So the other thing I just wondered about is you talked about, obviously, you told us about being this sort of quiet boy from the country, but you also say you found strength in your shyness. So I wonder how you could share maybe how something like shyness, which I think, you know, there's a lot of people who are therapists who feel quite shy. They might be frightened of being visible, for example, or they might be quite quiet people and they aren't sort of people who would push themselves forward. How has that become a strength, do you think? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think the word you use there, invisible, that's a word I've heard a lot and that I'm used to. I am used to being invisible. I think it gives me that connection because I am able to watch. I have picked up so much, you know, and actually when you do have a shy client that maybe doesn't know how counselling works, you can get to their level. You don't have to force it. You can kind of almost say, okay, let's scrap the session. Let's just sit. Let's just have a conversation. That's all we're doing right now. So I think it's knowing that I've been there. There's still times when, yeah, I still get nervous with a new client. But again, I think I'm in that space where I will let them know that I'm nervous as well.
Yeah.
So just because they think that they're the only ones that are nervous, it's like, actually, no, I still get nervous. I get excited. You know, I was nervous before doing this podcast. So it's that thing of knowing that you can do it and actually that you're relatable and you get it. And that shy quietness that maybe nobody kind of paid attention to me, but actually I was paying attention. I was watching, I was listening, I was observing. And now I know that's almost my autistic strength as well. You know, so it's everything is relatable.
Yeah.
Everything is on play when you're a counsellor. Like I said before, it's not, I think I've kind of got to the point, and this might shock people, but to me, it's maybe about 20% theory. The rest of it is all yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's about maybe your bus has been late. So you know that when a client turns up, if they're talking about the bus being late, you know how that feels.
Mm.
You know, you're not kind of sitting there going, conditions of worth, locus of evaluation, stuff that actually the client might not know what that means. It's being relatable, being human, meeting them where they are, and that works.
Yeah. I think a sort of what I'm hearing as we go along, and I hope that the people who are listening will agree with me here, is that what I'm getting is a lot of reassurance, actually. You know, it's okay to be you. It's okay to be human. It's okay to make mistakes. And that, of course, is something that's really important to us as good enough counsellors, because, you know, a lot of us want to be perfect. And actually what I'm hearing from you is, no, you're not going to be perfect and that's all right. I think that's really helpful. So we're just sort of coming to the close. I mean, the time's just whizzed by. Just to sort of finish off, what's something you wish you'd known when you first started your practice?
Oh, I guess that it's okay to be yourself.
Yeah,
I think that would have really helped. I think the technical thing I wish I knew was how to write a profile.
Right.
You know, that was never taught.
Yeah.
So that based with actually you're okay. You know, like we said before, you're good enough. And actually being yourself, that's really helped. But that's taken time to get to that point. And kind of throw off, just kind of throw away the theory a little bit.
Yeah, it's that sort of like, I mean, theory is useful. It's a great container, but it mustn't become a cage. I think that's the difference, isn't it? We can box ourselves in, really, can't we, in terms of thinking it's got to be like this. And I think it's very interesting that you said, you know, to be yourself and to learn how to write a profile, because I think those two actually really go together. Like you said, you've sort of after 2 years, you're now writing a profile that really reflects you, because as you've become more comfortable with being you, that's reflected in your writing. And I think ultimately that's what really attracts people to us, is when they can see the real person. So I'm surprised the two go together. And finally, what's next for you in your Louder Than Words counselling practice? Are there any projects or goals that you've got coming up that you're excited about?
So I'm currently training to be a psychologist, which is not a route that I saw coming.
Mm-hmm.
I think I want to be a supervisor at some point, because again, There's not many neurodivergent ones out there.
Yep.
And I think I'm just enjoying the ride and seeing where it goes, you know, and I think it's all about meeting the right people at the right time.
Yeah.
And stepping outside of the comfort zone and seeing what's out there. I mean, yes, I say I'm the shy, quiet kid from the country, but actually I'm capable of much more.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just enjoying the ride at the moment and seeing what happens.
Brilliant. That's wonderful. Well, Croy, thanks so much for coming along. And if people wanted to make contact with you, how could they get hold of you?
Yeah, so if they want to go to the website, which is louderthanwordscounselling.com, just drop us a line. That's where they can get hold of me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming along. And as I say, I hope this will do what we hoped it would do, which is to really sort of reassure people and help people to be comfortable, especially if they're neurodivergent and that they can do the work like you've proved. So thank you so much for coming along.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. For more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.